Hi everyone, it's Bud, and welcome to the latest episode of Before the Cheering Started, all about the journey to success and professional fulfillment. What does an environmentalist look like? Mike Richter was the New York Rangers goaltender for the 1990s and early 2000s, leading the team to the Stanley Cup Championship in 1994, the team's first in 54 years. He was one of my favorite athletes to cover during my sports reporting days, honest, thoughtful, and there was always a sense that he understood that there was a world beyond the field of play. After retiring in 2003 because of a concussion, Richter went to Yale, earned a degree, and started working in the world of green technology. He's currently the president of Brightcore Energy, a provider of clean energy solutions to commercial, industrial, and municipal buildings. When he initially expressed interest in the field, he started hearing an unusual question. Can you tell me where you were the first time you heard you don't look like an environmentalist?
Yeah, actually, I do. Well, first of all, I want to say thank you so much for having me, Bud. This is great. It's a long time and really appreciate you having me on. So fun to chat. The idea that you're not an environmentalist came when I was just retired. And understandably, you're old for your athletic career, but you're pretty young when it comes to the greater world. And at the time, I was probably 37, 38, and I was finishing up my undergrad at school after retiring. And I purposely joined a few not-for-profit boards for, you know, real two reasons. Number one, I would help out because these are ideas and causes that are dear to me. And the first one I joined was Riverkeeper. I used to live on 79th and Riverside in New York City. So mm-hmm. I went to the 79th Street Boat Basin and watched that beautiful Hudson River, the ice flows up and down all winter. And it was a backdrop to my apartment there. It was awesome. And the whole idea was just cleaning the Hudson, this great resource, 300 miles long. It's the eastern version of the Mississippi. And I was talking about joining the board to help out. The second aspect of it, because I agreed and believed in their mission, but second aspect of it was I wanted to learn. I've been in my own bubble for a long time, and these are successful people on all of these boards, and they have connections and different backgrounds and a foundation from which I could learn. And so they're like, well, that's great. I'm happy you're concerned and happy you share our interest, but, you know, it's kind of their stuttering and go, you're kind of an unlikely environmentalist. I was like, really? Is it the hair? I thought it was a funny statement, and I guess I can certainly understand that, particularly back then, it was less politicized, the whole environmental movement, I think, 20-some years ago. But it also, I suppose, it's always been, there's the generic kind of concept of everything from a politician to an environmentalist to somebody on Wall Street. And we all know that stereotypes don't work specifically. They may work generally sometimes. And so I found myself at the funny end of that stick.
So did you, there's also stereotypes about former athletes.
For sure.
And so did you find that you had to deal with that a lot as you established yourself in this career with various companies? Yeah. Or did it fade once people got that you were in, and you were in for all the right reasons, sure, and you're going to do the work, yep, that kind of faded quickly?
Yeah, well-earned, I may add. No, the idea that someone's knocking on your door and trying to sell you, in my case, a technical solution to make your building's performance and improve, which is what we do at Brightcore, this company, it might be interesting to take that call, but you better have good people around you. You better have done your homework, because I think there's two sides of that coin. They may take your call because of your prior life, but they're going to be more skeptical and perhaps should be. Why am I taking advice from a goalie? You're talking about my building envelope or how many BTUs I can save by, changing to a ground source heat pump. So I think you have to be a bit prepared to have some of that pushback. But generally speaking, if the door opens, you come and you walk through it with some good understanding and practical advice and real effort, people will accommodate you.
How goes the effort to have the word used be the word better as opposed to sustainable? And do you see that, is that something that's you're trying to have catch on?
Yeah, but I really feel strongly about this. I've been kind of using that phrase maybe too much, but you can start to see the evolution of what it means to be an environmentalist, what it means to conserve. Before it really was, you put on a sweater and you turn down the thermostat and you say, look, I'm going to basically make a sacrifice. And my environmental footprint, my carbon footprint will diminish because I'm freezing my backside off. This, I think technologies enable us to move that conversation, and the practical reality is to better technology that performs better, that feeds me better, that actually, because of its efficiencies, costs less to operate. And that could be transportation. You know, EVs aren't perfect, but aspects of them are better. The way they perform, the low center of gravity, the avoided maintenance, the low cost per mile, and really, actually, the plugging in aspect doesn't get discussed much, but to plug in a car in your garage and wake up in the morning not having to go to a gas station. And there is the range anxiety, which, you know, now they're starting to be – it's dissipating. I mean, they're getting cars up to 500 miles per full charge. So that's an example of better. If these things are safer, stronger, you know, more trunk room in the front, the frunk. But you'll start to think about – the way we heat and cool buildings. And a great example is a friend of mine that works here at the company who's head of our lighting department. And he was the end of useful life to a small house in Connecticut, and he decided to go geothermal. We don't do residential, but another company put it in there. And he came back and he said, after all you guys talk about how great geothermal is, it's going to save me money, it's this and that, it's more green, you guys didn't tell me how much better the experience would be. And it was an interesting conversation from somebody who's basically in that field. He's saying, you know, I run hot, my wife runs cold. We can separate these sections of our house. It does not, it modulates. It doesn't go warm and then cold. It's really stays at a perfect temperature. The humidity we can dial in. And he said, I didn't realize how much more quiet this is and how much better the experience is. The environment in which I live, he has a newborn, so it mattered to him. He was very hyper aware of this. But that's something I think the environmental community misses. We are dealing with replacing your operating system, whether it's a car or your house or the place of work, with a better operating system that costs less to run and has less externalities, i.e. it's more efficient.
So it struck me as I've heard you talk about the notion of buy-in, like when you go to a company and say, hey, you know, here's the buy-in, here's how much, or here's what you might spend for LED lighting. And I'm curious if you can draw a line from your athletic career when a coach asks you to buy in to a particular system and you played under different coaches, and perhaps that system or that personality will change. Is there some thread there that you understand you've been on their side because you've been asked to buy in as a player? And now you're asking a potential client to buy in to what you guys are selling.
Well, I saw a good quote that was attributed to Albert Einstein. He said, if you do what you've always done, you're going to get what you always got. And I think the biggest thing that we fight is not other companies doing what we do, and there's other good companies out there. It's inertia. We keep doing what we've always done. And then, you know, a guy like me knocks on your door and says, hey, I've got a better mousetrap. And you're going, why? My home's heating and cooling. It's fine. But it's not fine. You look and it's expensive and it can be unhealthy inside. You're seeing a lot of the kind of push to move from, you know, to a convection stove, an electric stove, to get fossil fuels out of the house. The combustion, no matter what it is, has some form of unhealthy gases coming out into your own home, which, you know, pushes childhood asthma and everything else. But of course, it's got an environmental footprint that we'd love to diminish if possible. But it's you're hitting us on a number of fronts, but you have to be aware that people are comfortable in what they're familiar with. And that goes as well for coaching staff to come in and say, hey, we're trying a whole new defensive system. You go, wait a minute, you know, we won the championship a year ago, or I've been here 10 years and I know how to play this game. Well, there has to be some buy-in, and it does take a little bit of a leap of faith sometimes. And part of my job is to diminish that perceived risk, because it's there. People should poke holes and ask questions. Why am I talking to you? Why are you coming in and reinventing the wheel? Is there an upside here? And unless I can point to it and get there quickly, that buy-in is going to be short-lived.
You know, the idea of this podcast is before the cheering started, but there's a whole fascinating for me notion of, for athletes, of after the cheering stops. Mm. And so I'm curious, during the middle of your career, or even in the latter parts of your career, and I understand you're involved game to game, and that's not so easily done in terms of having your mind set on other things or seeing a bigger world out there while you're focusing on playing as best as possible. But for you, was there a notion throughout, a kind of a thinking, maybe during the offseason, of, all right, what's the post-career going to look like? And was there a lot of that amongst your contemporaries, or was that kind of a rare thing?
It's a great question, bud. There was a bit of both, and it was very purposeful on both sides of this. I was going back before I was married with kids, and I left after my sophomore year at University of Wisconsin playing on the Olympic team, ultimately with Peter Laviolette and Tony Granato, my roommate from Wisconsin. And that's the first time in your life. I mean, it's the first time since I was probably 6 years old, you're not going to school. And it was odd. And so you're still going and playing hockey. You still have that love of the game, even more so because you're on a bigger stage now on the Olympic team. But we were traveling around since August. And this is the first time in your life just not going to school. And so your days are a lot more empty. And so there's only so much training you're going to do. And then there's a lot of rest and prep. And so I tried to continue to read a lot of nonfiction and educate myself a little bit. But I'd go back to school in the summertime. You have probably, 4 to 6 weeks, depending on when your season ended, to kind of regroup, go through injuries, perhaps, heal if you had an operation, get your mind away from it purposefully, and then start hitting it hard to get ready for the following season. And in that 4 weeks...
Didn't you go to Columbia a couple of summers, or one summer?
Before I lived full-time in the city, I was going to Cornell. My girlfriend at the time was in grad school there. I met Joe Nieuwendyk, who is a star for Calgary at the time, and later Dallas and New Jersey. And we hit it off great and became great friends and ended up living with him for summers, but going to summer school. And it was a perfect way to get your mind off of the intensity of the season, learn a little bit of new skill, keep your momentum, if you could call it that, you're just not backsliding a little bit and at least chipping away at that degree, which I always wanted to complete, even if for no other reason, mm-hmm. a sense of completion. But I love going to school at Cornell in the summer times, great place to work out, football stadium there, tremendous weights, everything else, hockey rink in the summer to go and skate. And then at some point, come July, you're full on and you're just working out. But that early May and June, you could take a 3 week or a 4 week class. And so I kept doing that. So to answer your question, yeah, there was this buildup of the next career. But there's a lot of downtime, as you've traveled with the team so much, and you're on flights across the coast. I roomed alone as a goalie. We always did. And so, you're getting in for a big game tomorrow. I'm not going ripping up on town. I've got hours to kill. It could be a movie. It could be playing cards with the guys. But it was often reading books about what I cared about. And it was that intersection of finance and ecology and the environment. And that interests me. I know on a kind of ethical level, there's something we need to do about it. It's affecting every aspect of our existence, from our economy to a quality of life. But also, just when you think about the economy, there's a huge market opportunity. If you create a better form of transportation or a better building envelope, whatever it is, there's a lot of demand for that. And there is going to be increasingly so. We're living in a resource-constrained world with kind of unlimited appetite to consume those things. So how do you get efficient by these things? And that's a lot of what I was reading, whether it's water or fossil fuels. So the flip side of that coin was, hey, man, you have this really small window in a professional athletic career. Don't waste one moment thinking about doing spending time elsewhere. And, you know, there was a good line. I used to work at, kind of on a strategic level every summer with a sports psychologist down in Florida. He's like, don't start your second career before you're done your first. And yeah, you can set yourself up. But that's not saying, you know, I want to go back to law school and that's going to take me into September. I'm going to come to camp a little bit. No way, man. You have to wrangle out every drop of opportunity that you have in a very unique and cherished opportunity, the career.
No names necessary, but from the people who are running the team, was that spoken or unspoken?
Oh, no, that was very much from me. You want to, for an athlete, your goal is to reach your potential. How am I helping the team? How am I going to walk away from the sport, which inevitably ends early, even if you have a long career, it's a short career. And you can't have any regrets. You have to say, I did everything I could to be as good as I could to help that team out as much as you can. It's the only way you can sleep at night. So if it's getting in the way of your preparation for the season, then it's a problem and truly a detriment. And I think irresponsible. But if it's a good way to just go, hey, man, I'm taking a 3-week course on anthropology. It's unbelievable. It's May. I take 2 weeks off to heal the body. I start running again. Got a great, you know, stadium to do the stairs and everything else. I found it to be such a good rhythm. And later on, I had kids, and that started being, all right, now I'm like juggling my workouts and kids and studies.
Right.
I put it aside and figured I'd go full time when I retired. But those years of doing it while I was single was really, I think, helpful. It kept that kind of connection to, you know, two lives, and did help set up where I am today.
Ever get any questions from guys on the plane as you're traveling to Calgary? Hey, Mike, what are you reading there?
I think it showed them why I was as boring of a conversationalist as I ultimately was. Wow, the coming wars for water. It's like, really, Mike? But it is interesting. You look at so much of what's going on now, and it's amplified, and it's increasingly, relevant. Whether it's climate refugees, the droughts that we're having, the wildfires, you know, the whole East was blanketed by smoke this summer, and you can't attribute one thing to climate change. But whether it's, you know, the war that's going on in Europe is going to dampen the production of wheat. You know, these things have worldwide effects now, and all of it comes down to the limited resources that we have. And any kind, there's a little bit of a hiccup, the repercussions are fairly large. So you ignore them at our own peril.
Do you recall a conversation at home growing up outside of Philadelphia, where you perhaps in middle school or in high school, you sit your folks down and you say, no, this isn't just a fun game that I'm playing. This is what I'm going to do.
Never really. I don't think I ever articulated it in such a manner. I just knew that that's more than anything what I wanted to do. I loved school. I loved my friends. But hockey, I absolutely loved. I loved all sports. All of my buddies played, you know, football. I did too, and track and soccer, but hockey was my love. And, not surprisingly had more success in it. And, but that's what we did every day. It was a new kind of challenge. And, but I can't remember a time that I didn't want to go to the pros. I grew up in Philadelphia. I was watching, you know, Hall of Famer Bernie Parent and Bobby Clark and Rick McLeish, and these guys were winning championships in the early 70s. So it was pretty easy to fall in love with the sport then. And Philly's a great sports town. So yeah, I can't remember a day that went by that I didn't kind of envision somehow making it.
Yeah, I was watching them too from upstate New York, but shockingly, I didn't have quite the love for them.
Very that easy team that shall not. Very easy team to hate from when you're outside of that. You know, it's funny.
Or as we say it here in this house, the team that shall not be named.
There you go. Is there
anything from your folks or from people in school like, hey, Mike, that's great. University of Wisconsin's great. Good luck to you, but, you know, the notion of a plan B, is it raised or is it unspoken?
Oh, yeah. My dad was pretty serious about it. You never want to dampen someone's fire. And I think he was quite astute. I was the youngest of seven, so at the very least, he had trial and error. But I mean, he was great with that. Never would stand in the way of your goals or your dreams. But, you know, really, fortunately and realistically, you can do both. I mean, look at Fox. I mean, there's a world-class player coming from Harvard. You know, so in ice hockey, you can truly develop as a top player and get into the highest, you know, league in the world and take the route through university to get there. And so that's and top university too. So it didn't have to be mutually exclusive is what I'm saying. And my father recognized this and go get them, do everything you can, be as good as you can in every direction. And, you know, the world will give you the feedback that you're looking for one way or another.
Decision to leave Wisconsin early. Was there a conversation about that at home?
Yeah, it was actually hard. My father passed away early in my freshman year. So 2 years later, I'm at that point of looking to sign a contract with the NHL, with the Rangers. And, you know, I it was all systems go for me from, you know, if I could sign when I was 10 years old, I would have, of course. But the question is, are you ready for it? And are you doing the right thing at the right time for your development? And it became increasingly clear that there's a window that opens when you run through it and take advantage of it. You certainly don't want to leave prematurely and be riding the bus in the minors for, you know, three uncomfortable years and then saying, gee, well, maybe I could have stayed at Wisconsin and then tried this. But at the same time, you know, there's an organization that is looking at you and evaluating where you are in your own development and saying, do you need the next step? And very fortunate, you know, the Olympics in 88, which would have been my junior year. So the tryouts were after my sophomore year. It was a great stepping stone. I mean, that was an enormous, that's back when the, you know, Soviet team was still playing. It was, I think, the last time they were together. So it a great competition. And to have that half measure to get to even the AHL level, then the pros, was really important for me and very, very helpful. So you hop up from Division I college and then say, okay, do I go back to Division I college? It's not like I won every game I played. I have a lot of work to do. But at the same time, pushing yourself a bit more to the next level, which would have been the minors then. The Rangers weren't saying, you're going to come in and take Johnny Van Beesbrouck out. You're like, here, sign. You've been working. You've been practicing. Now apply yourself. And it was awesome. The level of competition in the minors. Back then, the Rangers had the Denver Rangers prior to, that's how old I am, in the IHL prior to the Avalanche coming to be there. And great sports town in Denver. Awesome, though. The competition was great. Great players we played against, guys that, you know, you end up playing against your whole career because they graduated up to the NHL with you. I love the idea of kind of honing a skill and getting better, and practice is fun, and putting yourself towards something and trying to reach your potential is really what sports is about. So I welcome the challenge. I had great support and great coaching, and it was awesome.
That notion of learning from mistakes, learning from hard times, yeah. Is that something that you knew was going to happen? Or when you first go through it, is that, oh, wait a minute. Oh, this is, you know, it's not a straight line. Yeah. To get where I want to get to.
Yeah. And I think it's easy to tell yourself it's not a straight line as soon as you screw up, but it's a real thing.
Right.
Being battle tested, working through problems, challenges, some self-imposed, others just, that's what sports is. It's a series of challenges, putting yourself out there on a limb and starting to solve, because you're going in front of 20,000 people and saying, you know, in an opposing building saying, I'm going to save every shot. And, you're either ready for that or you're not. And I can remember at one point, you know, I'd gone through after the Olympics and gone through into the playoffs on the minor leagues, getting to training camp, felt great, had a good goals against average, successful in camp, feeling like I've arrived. And I played a couple games. Roger Nielsen was the coach. Neil Smith was the new GM, and they were great to me. Remember Neil calling and just being very encouraging and, you know, work, and we have a lot of upside. And so I was with the top team for a little while and got sent to the minors and thought, wow, you know, I'm ready. Why am I in the minors? But there were plenty of times where I wasn't good enough or I had aspects of my game to improve. And being sent there does light a fire under you, is disappointing, but it's also, well, you can wallow in sadness or you can say, how am I getting better? How do I make this ironclad so anything that comes my way, I'm prepared for. And you get to a point, I really do believe, where you're just saying, does not matter the challenge, I'll figure it out. And that's a really powerful place to be. And I don't think that comes without running into challenges and figuring a way through it and understanding how you react to them. And that's what I love about sports. And that's what makes it gratifying to have success, is that you've been through hardships. But I think in any position, whether you're a leader in a corporation, a small business like mine, or the New York Rangers, you want somebody coming in there. You want to give them the responsibility, but you also want to have the confidence that I know this guy can work through problems, because problems come your way. That's life. Mm-hmm. That is sport.
I'm going to ask you about one game of 1,000 games that you played, or thousands of games. Not even one game. One part of one period that I think about maybe an inordinate amount of time. So it's the Messier game, the Messier hat trick game, game 6 against the Devils in the conference finals, which, no disrespect to that gentleman, who was a pretty fair hockey player, as I remember.
He was way around the rink, yeah.
Yeah, he's got a couple of rings there. Yeah. But the score is 2-0 early in the second period, and thanks to you, the score stays at 2-0, because if the score goes up to 3 or 4-0 Devils, the history might be a lot different. Hockey is an amazing, at the risk of saying something obvious, an incredibly fast sport. So the notion of thinking, or like, well, what does this guy like to do? You know, that seems like it happens too fast for that. But is there some notion, perhaps during a stoppage in play, early in that period of, you know, the big picture is this, I cannot let this get to 3-0. Or can that kind of thinking kind of cloud your thinking and keeping your mind free of just playing the game and trying to stop every shot?
Yeah, great question. Mike Keane, talk about a challenge. He pushed all of us that year. And it didn't matter whether we won 5 in a row or just lost one. He was going to come in angry and he's going to demand more. And that became very much our kind of mantra, like, be better, push more. The team matters. Doesn't matter whether we're winning 4-0, make it 7-0 if that, you know, means getting better. And it doesn't matter whether we just lost the last period. Let's go out. If we're going into the third period down by 4, find a way to win. Find a way to get that first goal and claw yourself back into it. And he really, you know, Glennie Healy and myself, the two goalies, we were in games and then pulled out and then put back in. And it in a way, I don't know how purposeful it is, but it's all to an end. And that is to toughen yourself up and make your practices and make the atmosphere so demanding that you're battle tested when you see the other team. But for a goaltender, if I tell you, bud, go out there and hustle, what does that mean? It's not the same as a lineman in football or even a forward in hockey, where I can just say, all right, my hands aren't working, but I'm going to move my feet. I'm going to go hit somebody. I can work hard. Working hard for a goaltender kind of means focusing more. I can't save the puck harder. I can't force that guy to shoot. Man, it might be down the other end against Marty for 10 shots in a row, and I'm just watching. But I better be prepared when that next one comes on my end. And I think over the course of your career, that's what it means to be reliable, is that you're moment to moment ready to play, ready to focus, and you're on top of it. All of your energy is going into that moment. Not what just happened, the goal or great save you just had. Not what could happen, well, I could be pulled, right here, right now. I remember that first period, and all I could think of is you know, I was leaving the hotel that morning and doors opened up and there's Mike Keenan. You know, everybody had seen a lot of each other and we just looked at each other. There's nothing to say. I just looked at him. It's an elimination game. We just looked at each other and we just started chuckling. Nothing to say. Like, this is it, man. Just go out there and execute. And in that game, you know, they scored early. I think Lemieux had a tip, and of all people, you know, he is such a great player, but such a pest to play against. And, then they made it 2-0. I wasn't looking at the bench. I'm like, don't pull me. I felt good. I know we can pull this out, but just don't even worry about what's going to happen. Just save the next shot. Just stop the bleeding. And we were able to. And that's a sign of a veteran team when, You know, it wasn't like we were just perfect every game or throughout every series. There were punches and counterpunches back and forth throughout that entire series. And New Jersey pushed us so much, and they had every right to think they were going to win that game and that series. But there's two heavyweights going at it. And so they took, you know, maybe they won the first round. We're going to come back and get the second round. And that was just a great, you know, wrestling match that we had. And I to this day, thank them in a way. Like, it was seventh game, double OT. That's the stuff that you think about when you're out in the driveway as a little kid saying, Stanley Cup, you know, you're going to be in overtime in the seventh game. And look, winning a cup, there's never a bad time or a bad place to do it. But to win in New York and to win after being pushed like that, in 2 7th games in a row in two series, that's pretty satisfying.
I do recall, credit where credit is due, I do recall speaking to Messier after that game, and he said, no, this is Mike Richter's game. Richter's the reason why we run this game.
That's mess, right?
And,
I mean, he
and he was right.
The game winner, and he's quick to dish it to other people.
That's right. That speaks to him. Yeah, it speaks about him. I covered more than a few retirement ceremonies, and I have to say, you had the greatest line of anyone at any retirement ceremony. And I'm quoting here, right about now, I'm wondering whose idea it was to get a guy who has retired from head injuries to memorize a speech in front of 18,000. That was perfect.
That was funny.
You know, New York loves a lot of things, you know, a champion, hard work, wear your emotions on your sleeve, all of that thing. But New York loves a good line, too. That was pretty great.
I don't remember how that came to be, but I Johnny Rosasco, who was the head of PR there, just said, well, you know, we're going to have a ceremony. He was an understated guy.
Right.
You know, it all was kind of happening so quick. I'm still processing the fact my career is over, let alone that they're going to hold my number up there. And he just said, you know, you got to be there on the 4th, and there'll be a little ceremony. You give a 5-minute speech, and that's all I'm going to tell you. And like, that kind of was it. It wasn't like, who am I addressing? How long? What? Where do I walk out of?
Right.
And then you go there, and it's just, you know, unbeknownst to me, they had been asking my sister and my mom for pictures of me when I was a kid, and they were putting up this collage. Right. And, you know, the things that they did on that night were, you know, I'll never forget, and I can never repay. They're, you know, from the fans to the organization, they just couldn't have been better. But it was funny because I did go in there. I did work on a speech. I understood that I had to give a speech, and that's – cool. And it is really amazing because that is the one moment where you're not preparing for a game. You know, you get an award at player of the week or something, the month, or hey, thanks very much. We got to go win this game. I'm saying the problem.
I got Mario Lemieux to worry about.
Yeah, there's bigger fish to. But this one was like, look, man, you're saying thank you. And it's not just a little bit of thank you. Those 18,000 people and everybody watching, that creates the entire opportunity you have. And, you know, through thick or thin, they were behind us. So that, it was overwhelming.
It's also a moment to recognize all the shoulders that you stand on, of which there are many.
In
any field.
Yeah, great teammates, great coaches, the people that, you know, helped you as a kid, all the sacrifice your family made. It is overwhelming because you want to get up there and thank everybody personally and in a meaningful manner. You know, I just watching the, was it the Grammys or whatever was on recently. And it's just, you know, everybody gets something, they speak as fast as they can. Oh, my manager, this, then they're doing the same thing. But in that position, you are grateful and you should be because you didn't do it alone. Now you don't want to leave anybody out. And how can you repay the support you had in that minuscule moment? But it means the world. And I didn't know how much it was going to mean to me at the time. You couldn't, but now to be, you know, retired forever, a Ranger is a really amazing thing.
Do you ever get calls or have you gotten calls from current or former players asking you questions about concussions?
Yeah. And I answer them because I know when I had mine, I talked to Jeff Bookaboom. I talked to Patty LaFontaine. I talked to friends who have had them and are still playing, those that had to retire. And what you learn, and it's kind of hard to understand in the beginning, is it affects everybody differently. You know, my hit's not the same hit that maybe you had, Bud. And history of concussions, it might be different than yours. How soon I got hit after a major blow, you know, really influences what kind of repercussions I have from that subsequent hit. these things all go into play. So you go in there going, well, it wasn't that bad. What's going on? I'm out for the year. I was shocked when the neurologist said, you know, I'm not going to clear you to play. I was like, what are you talking about? You know, later on, I started understanding what she was talking about because I felt worse as time went on. Like it started progressively getting more exhausted and less sleep and more headaches and everything else. It felt off at the time it happened in December, but you know, through Christmas into the new year, I was still feeling the effects. The next 3 to 4 weeks were a real kind of slide into a morass. And when she said, you know, it's going on too long, I'm not clearing you to play this season. You know, I'm not going to clear you to play your career. I was feeling so physically bad that it was just like, I just want to get my life back. You know, I've got young kids. I felt awful. You know, you couldn't stay awake during the day and at night. I couldn't seem to fall asleep. Your head always hurt. Bright lights affected you. Your hearing was off. I was dizzy. God, it was like a major hangover that lasted, you know, 2 months. And so Everybody goes through different things. And she said, you will recover, you'll come out of it, but you're not going to come out of it, perhaps. And we don't know, but if you get hit again. So, you know, there's a risk profile that we have here that we have to honor. And then you say, look, your whole orientation as an athlete is, I'm fine, put me in, I'll get through it. I feel, you know, I have a cold, I have a twisted ankle, I've got a hamstring. Hey, it's the seventh game. Make that kid, you know, that calculation, boom, I'm going. And this one was a little different where I had to take some time myself. I couldn't even admit to my wife that was in, you know, that she had suggested I hang up my career. It was just that emotional and that overwhelming. And you're like, let me take a little bit of quiet time here. I was up in Montreal when she told me, and I just said, I don't tell Slats, don't tell the coaching staff, the medical staff, just give me a few hours to process this because I don't even know how to deal with it. Now, to be fair, the organization has decisions to make. Like if you're truly not going to be able to be cleared to play, I've got a decision. I can override the doctor and get my own insurance and take that risk or, you know, abide by it. But they have decisions to make, who to draft, who to trade for, right. How to orient the rest of the year. So, you know, you're just thinking about how can I get back in the lineup? And now you're staring at, you know, truly the next chapter of your life. And that was hard.
Obviously, with BrightCore, you're connected to all the projects that you're doing, not, you know, placing them in terms of priority. But can I imagine that the project that you did at Madison Square Garden has a little bit of a synthesis of, oh, wow, my two worlds are kind of coming together here.
For sure. And
that's sweet.
And back to your initial question, you know, the unlike the environmentalist, I don't think so. It's about performance. You know, if I'm an athlete, everything I do is oriented to how do I perform tonight, what I eat, how long I sleep, my liquid intake, you know, how hard I worked out, everything, all oriented to be at my best. We do that in every aspect of our life, hopefully, but certainly in the corporate world. You know, Goldman Sachs tries to beat out their competition not by being inefficient. And so Part of that equation is where we spend our time at home and in buildings. Built environment is, you spend, you know, more time than you do outside. It's we spend something like 20 hours a day in the built environment. If these things aren't performing to their max, that inefficiency is causing pollution, causing the environment in which we live and work to be dimly lit, poorly conditioned, means that we're not as efficient. So I think there's a real connection there. And the real connection ultimately, though, especially for an athlete, where I think we do have a leg to stand on, is just health and performance are so intricately connected that, I think coming back to MSG, making the controls and the lighting better and tuned into what they need, you know, in the coach's room versus the player's room versus the, you know, medical room, these things, you're kind of customizing the performance there. So, all really cool, and I'm fortunate to have the first career, let alone the second. So I appreciate you giving me a little platform to discuss it. Great to see you.
It's a great story. It was always a pleasure talking to you 30 years ago. It's still a pleasure talking to you.
But thanks so much for having me. Really cool stuff.
Mike Richter. Before the Cheering Started is a production of June 14th Productions and Gemini 13 Productions. And yes, June 14th, refers to the night that Mike Richter and the New York Rangers won the Stanley Cup, June 14th, 1994. This episode was created and written by me. Guitar playing, that's me as well, no extra charge. I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is Before the Cheering Started. Thanks for joining us on the journey.